NEPM's podcasts are funded by Armbrook Village Senior Living in Westfield, offering assisted living and Compass memory support with evidence-based treatment for those with memory loss. More at armbrookvillage.com. The Fabulous 413 podcast is funded by Northeast Solar, helping customers make the switch to solar for savings, energy security, and tax incentives. Learn more at northeast-solar.com.
Welcome to the Fabulous 413. I'm Khalees Smith.
And I'm Monty Belmonte. For the second time, we're going to take the whole show and focus on one topic.
That topic being our friend Phil Korman, who has gone on so many agricultural adventures with us here on the show time and again.
It is Phil's last week as executive director at CESA, Community Involved in Sustaining Agriculture. So we thought we'd spend some time honoring the changes he's been able to instigate with that organization over the years.
We'll hear from two farmers that have been involved with CESA's board at both ends of Phil's tenure, Mike Wisman of Warner Farm and the maize that bears his name, and Kat Chang of Reed's Farm.
And from the man himself, as we get his own words about both our time together and his time at such an important organization for the area.
First, let's crash the tour that CESA organizes for Congressman Jim McGovern each year, where he gets an overview of the farms in the area and the issues affecting them. Time for the farm tour.
So while this is a show that is a long goodbye to Phil Korman, it's really a deep dive in local agriculture because it is not only the official day of Phil Korman of CESA's retirement party, it is the annual U.S. Congressman Jim McGovern farm tour of the 413. Day two will be more central Mass. Psh, we don't care about that.
I mean, technically, the show is the 413, and there's no 413 in Central Mass.
That's true.
They bleed a little bit over into us with the 978 business.
Yeah. But. And to make it a little more confusing, we're at Amherst Nurseries, but in Hadley.
Yes. If you come here, it's near Hartsbrook School. My GPS tried to send me to an entirely different place.
We're all going around and introducing ourselves. There's all sorts of fancy bigwigs here from McGovern's office and the USDA.
Louder, please.
John Swords with the Congress.
Joanna Shields, MDR.
Khalees Smith, NEPM.
Monty Belmonte, full-time dreamer.
Lisa from CESA.
Ashley Randall, MDAR.
John Kinchla. I grow trees and do landscaping contracting.
How come it's called Amherst Nurseries, but you're in Hadley?
So that's a good question. It started in Amherst many, many years ago, and we were on Route 9 doing retail sales for about 10 years. But we outgrew the site, and we just really needed one spot to work out of. We were working out of multiple locations at that point, and when you're moving trees around, you have to do it as few times as possible.
Yeah.
They're too heavy.
But you still have multiple sites to grow at.
I do. Right now, we're just growing here in Hadley, but we are in the process of building a barn in Charlemont and growing up there.
Is it just commercial or residential, too, for your nursery?
So the nursery side is wholesale only. But we also do landscaping, so some of what we're growing gets funneled through the landscaping business, and that's commercial and residential.
We're going to take a little tour of what your farm is all about and learn all about it and go walking through the fields with the congressman and the USDA and Mass Department of Agricultural Resources and more. Thanks for having us all here.
You're welcome. Thank you for coming. Our main niche is urban forestry. We grow trees for urban areas. We sell to municipalities, state agencies. We're not making widgets, that's for sure.
No.
It's a struggle in the winter because with the weather we've been having, as you all know, 2 years ago with that really cold snap we had in February, that was tough for us. And then we had that late freeze that year in May. All the leaves died. The tree had to redo that, and it takes a lot of energy to make that happen. I'm definitely very interested in what the government's doing with climate. We talked about weather. I'd like to mention that last year's wet weather was pretty difficult for us, like every farm. But what you might not expect is that droughts are maybe worse for us because our customers in a drought year, the cities and towns, they're just not planting. If they've got a water ban in their community, they can't go out and plant trees and then start watering them. What I've noticed in the last, was it 2016 we had a drought? Then 2 years ago we had that drought. And they were both pretty bad. So that's two pretty bad droughts in less than 10 years. But I think that the drought monitor really could use some improvement. I don't think there's enough data points there. I've heard that in Berkshire County, the North Adams Airport is the only data point. USDA, they've funded an irrigation system here that goes from my black truck there, the pipe goes all the way out back, and it's probably close to a mile of piping and wiring, and it's really made a huge difference here. The challenge I had with that grant was they said, well, you're on hydric soils. Why would you need irrigation? problem is, yes, we are on hydric soils. It's a blessing and a curse, because what happens is we plant in the spring, and then inevitably we get a dry spell, usually like sometime in June. And you sit there and you're like, cross your fingers that it's going to rain. But now with the irrigation system, we just put out drip. It required a little bit of education for USDA to see the value in the irrigation system for us. Like I said, not many people have been to a production nursery, so you don't really understand what's involved. Soil conservation is really what I'm interested in when it comes to nursery production. And that's why I like the grow bags. My customers like it because they're easier to handle, but I like them because we're not sending our soil off the farm. The industry demands that you do make bald and burlap trees, but if anybody is here who is in a developmental role and is looking for a project, you know, it'd be great to see if there's some type of way to do less B&B and more of something else that will keep the soil on the farm.
Who decides all this stuff? Like, I mean, you know, you're saying you want to change the standard. Who makes those decisions?
So landscape architects are pretty heavily involved. Yeah. One thing that's been hurting us, it's like death by a thousand cuts. It's just increasing regulation. And it's not necessarily federal regulation. A lot of it comes from the state. A lot of it involves Mass DOT. I have a lot of frustration with the way DOT does things. They've put these regulations on people that operate truck and trailer combinations over 10,000 pounds. A lot of pickup trucks themselves weigh over 10,000 pounds. So now you have to have a DOT health card.
It's funded by Pekarsky Sausage and South Deerfield, specializing in farm-made fresh and smoked sausages and select smoked pork and poultry.
More information at Pekarsky.com. It's only 20 minutes of your time, but that's not true, because maybe once you're good at it, it's 20 minutes, but it's times all your employees and all your trailers and all your trucks. So it really is tough to deal with. Overtime is an issue, and it's becoming a bigger issue. There's like a tightening noose around agriculture for overtime, and it doesn't really affect us as much, because I pay all of my people overtime, whether we are on the farm or off the farm, because we do mix it. Like, the guys will be on a landscape job and then on a farm job, so I just pay the overtime, and I'm happy to do it. But I know other farms are having trouble with this, because they need to separate out their employees. If you've got someone on a packing line, they're subject to overtime, but if somebody's in the field, they're not. It's impossible almost to separate that out unless you're at a certain scale. And there's a trend now in the state to even go further with overtime and just require agriculture to be subject to OT. I think they're missing the point that agriculture is very unique. You know, we're not making widgets, like I said before, and we have busy periods. I think that's something that needs to be on the radar for anybody who's supporting agriculture. A couple more things I want to say. We brought out another machine. This is a Mean Green mower. That's the brand. At one point, I had three of those, and the idea was that they're lithium battery powered. You can see there's a lot of dust on that machine, and it had a flat tire earlier. So we have not used it much in probably 2-3 years. And the reason is, unfortunately, even though it emits zero emissions, and the batteries work really, really well, the components that it's built with are just not up to commercial use. And we've just started to have so many problems with them. It almost got to the point where, like, every single day we would have a problem. And they got bought out by a bigger company. When that happened during COVID, the price of parts doubled. So it's a sad story. We had three of them. We have two now. I don't even feel good about selling them, because who knows if they're going to run for the next person. So we're trying to repurpose the batteries for something. But the batteries are great. You drive a gas mower for an hour, it's like driving a pickup truck for 2,500 miles. It's like crazy. So, you know, you think about all those emissions, and there's very little maintenance with those until they start to break down.
Are these manufactured in the U.S.?
They are, yeah. You know, everybody wants to move to battery-powered equipment, but it is unreliable at this point, from what I can tell. If you gave me a good machine at a reasonable price, I'd buy it. But now I'm skeptical, right? I want to see it work in the field for 5 years. That had like 400, 500 hours on it before it started to give us trouble. But the first 400 hours were great. I have, for a number of years, been a member of the Citizens Climate Lobby. In case you don't know, that's a nonpartisan group, which I think is very important. And they lobby for a carbon fee and dividend at the federal and state level. And the dividend part is important. At the wholesale level, somewhere up the pipeline, fossil fuels come into your economy. They get taxed. So trickle down the pipeline to the retail level, you're paying a higher price for that fuel. And the idea is to ratchet the tax up over time so it drives innovation away from fossil fuels. And people will say, well, that's going to increase my costs. So this is the good thing about carbon fee and dividend, the dividend part, which is important. And if you're a legislator, you need to keep that in it if it ever gets passed. The way I look at it is there's really no way around this situation we're in with the climate. We're going to have to do something. It would be nice if we were more proactive than reactive. And I look at a carbon fee and dividend as a proactive way of getting this job done. Right now, we're just in the throes of like this chaotic system that is driving industry away from fossil fuels, but really has no solutions and is undercapitalized to do that. And we're all feeling it.
I don't know whether anybody has any questions before we take a walk, but no, this has been helpful, and I appreciate your dedication to dealing with the climate issue. You know, part of the problem is the fossil fuel industry is very powerful. There's too much money in our political system. But you're right. I mean, we have to be proactive, and we're running out of time.
Yeah.
And you're talking about the weather patterns. I mean, things are changing rapidly.
And a lot of farms rely on frozen ground. Cranberry growers, vegetable growers, we all rely on some type of frozen surface in the winter to do certain things, and it's just not happening. It's amazing, actually. I can't, in the last probably 5 years, it's just astounding.
Coming up, CISA board members past and present reflect on their time with the organization, and we'll talk with Phil Corman about his past 16 years helming that particular ship.
Next, the youngest Bay State arborist, poultry congress, tree tips, kind words for our leaving friend, and more as we continue our farm tour at Amherst Nurseries.
You're listening to the Fabulous 413 on 88.5 NEPM.
Ashley Randall, Commissioner of MDAR.
Nice shirt. Thanks.
You got your MDAR shirt on.
Yes.
Do you choose which farms Congressman McGovern checks out on this farm tour, or how did that come about?
His team works with CISA to be able to identify the farms. We're here for moral support.
And you got a lot of great shout-outs because a lot of the grants that helped make a lot of things happen on this farm came from MDAR.
And actually, the farm received one of the natural disaster recovery grants last year as well. And that, we heard, was the $20 million that Senator Comerford and Rep. Blay really pushed for. That helped farms be able to farm again this year.
Let's go talk to that arborist over there. Are you the 16-year-old arborist?
Yes, I am.
What's your name?
Priya McSweeney.
Where do you live?
I live in Chesterfield.
That's a ways.
Yeah, it's like 45 minutes.
Yeah.
You're the youngest certified arborist in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts?
Yes.
In the history of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts?
As far as we know, yeah.
That's great.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
When in the summer did that happen?
It was April that I took the test, and I found out about a week after, so.
What was the hardest question on the test?
I can't remember. There were so many.
Is it like a written
multiple,
test, or are you in the field?
Yeah, it was
multiple choice.
Yeah, I had to drive out kind of to like the Boston area to take it, so I can't remember.
You come from an arborist family, though, right?
Yep. My dad is an arborist and horticulturalist, and he owns his own business, which I also work for, so.
So it's in the blood.
Yeah, pretty much.
You have two jobs and you're 16.
Yeah. I'm also homeschooled.
Okay.
And I'm also taking classes at Smith College, just auditing, which I'm starting next week.
16.
So. Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you think you're going to keep working with trees for the foreseeable future, or is this just to kind of like get to where you're of age of majority and want to do something else maybe?
No, I love plants, like anything to do with them. So I hope I continue working in this industry.
But the entourage has walked away without us. We got to catch up now.
Sorry.
Matt, what do you do here at Amherst Nurseries?
I'm the foreman for the tree nursery and the landscaping division.
What kind of stuff do you got going on tree-wise right now?
We're getting to the digging season.
So is now a good time to be planting trees?
Now is a good time. As we're getting to the fall, it's a great time to plant a tree.
I have a giant linden tree in my yard, but the limbs are kind of overhanging the sidewalk. Is now a good time to work on limbing trees?
As trees get dormant, yes, you can start pruning them.
So I shouldn't worry and wait until all the leaves are falling off. I'm good to do it now?
You're good to do it now.
Sage advice. Thank you, man.
You're welcome.
My name's Amanda Kinchla.
And you are one of the owners of Amherst Nurseries?
I am. John is my husband.
And this is a beautiful farm, a beautiful nursery growing all these trees. And it was great to hear from your husband about some of the trials and tribulations and needs and grants and things that came about. But your daughter is, who I know, is also a fun story right now.
Yes, my daughter is a 4-H poultry member where she competes in chicken shows. And so the biggest chicken show around the area is the Poultry Congress. It's at the Big E in January.
Is Congressman McGovern part of the Poultry Congress?
I haven't
seen him there.
I haven't seen him there, but it doesn't mean he hasn't been there. Jan Bratt.
Oh, the illustrator?
The author illustrator is a huge poultry fan.
Whoa!
And she's there all the time.
I love her.
If I remember correctly, Martha Stewart has also been there, because if you want to get a good breed of chicken, this is where all the people go.
I had a dumb question about how birds get elected to Poultry Congress, but you were mentioning that your daughter's birds do particularly well in agility?
Oh, yeah. Well, this is a few years ago. But yes, at the Poultry Congress, there's a variety of different competitions. It's best in show, like a dog show. They look at the breed and all sorts of handling, depending on which type of contest you're in. But one, a few years ago, my daughter won the agility contest, which is where you tame your chicken to move around a table doing all sorts of obstacles, like going up a ramp, weaving through poles, and it's on time.
How do you train a chicken to do that?
I mean, you spend a lot of time with them.
Yes, there's clicking and food, and she taps it on the table. It's quite entertaining. Yeah, she might kill me now that telling her she won when she was like 10 or something, but yes, she was a very proud moment. Kylie now breeds Brahmas. And she got the best in show at the Heath Fair this year.
Those are super pretty.
Mm-hmm.
Now we know why the chicken crossed the road. It was being trained for agility.
It seems more like Chicken Olympics than like Congress. Yeah. What happens to your daughter's chickens when they're not at the Chicken Olympics?
Oh, well, they have to have a little downtime after the Olympics. So they're pampered here in the chicken coop.
Does anyone have any questions? Or are you getting into some of the native trees and plants and pollinators? Are you starting to see a demand for those?
So we're urban forestry, and there's a little conflict there because native trees are great, but our climate's changing, especially in an urban environment. So if it's 5 degrees warmer here, it's 10 degrees warmer in Springfield. And there aren't too many native trees that grow like a pencil to fit narrow places. So on the one hand, yes, we do sell a lot of native trees, but we're not targeting that market. They just happen to be in our repertoire. We're really looking to suit the needs of like professional arborists in the city. A lot of this is driven by energy conservation. And so they're planting trees with the idea that they're going to either shade the ground or shade like a hard surface that would accumulate heat, or they're going to seasonally shade a house and reduce their cooling needs. A lot of this grew out of the Asian longhorn beetle infestation in Worcester. And what the state realized was when they cut down all the trees in Worcester, they could take the energy bills and see a spike in energy use, especially in the summer, but also in the winter. They were able to like correlate that with the loss of tree canopy, and they started to fund the reforestation of Worcester through, I believe it was like a small, like very small amount of money on your energy bill. And they've expanded that program to 10 cities now across the state. Westfield's one of them, Chicopee, Holyoke has been part of it, the so-called gateway cities.
We also launched this thing called the Worcester Tree Initiative, where we raise private money to get people trees and teach people about trees. I didn't know any about trees.
Yeah.
We're giving trees out to people, and they said, would you plant this tree? I said, dig a deep, deep hole and cover it up. And the answer was no. It's a very shallow hole for trees to survive. But people learned a lot about trees and became appreciated them in a way they never did before. Some of the replanting in Worcester has been complicated because we have power lines that run down the street, and the old trees were big, and they'd be cutting out holes in the top of the trees so the power lines go through, so the trees they planted don't grow as high. So people are not happy about that. But I always said, that's state government, not me. We got to go back. We have to go back, yeah.
Excited about this annual farm tour, Congressman?
I am. We're doing 5 farms today and 6 tomorrow. And, I'm on the Agriculture Committee. This gives me an opportunity to learn firsthand about what's happening in my district, the different kinds of farms. You know, a lot of times people, when you talk about farms, don't think about nurseries. Well, this is a farm. Agriculture is an important part of our local economy. And here in Massachusetts, our farms are not corporate farms or mega farms. They're small and medium-sized farms. And we need to find ways to be wind at their back and to support them. And that's why we do this farm tour. And I have people from USDA and from the state here as well to figure out what's working and what's not and how we can help. And what I really appreciate about this farm, too, is the kind of dedication toward combating climate change and protecting the soil and finding better ways to farm.
A lot of people are concerned about the Farm Bill, which is one of the most important pieces of legislation. It's been sort of at a standstill. What's the latest with the Farm Bill?
Yeah, well, the Farm Bill that came out of the House Agriculture Committee, in my opinion, is a rotten bill. As you know, I do a lot of work on hunger and nutrition. That bill would cut nutrition by, and SNAP in particular, by $30 billion, billion with a B. My other problem with the farm bill that came out of the House is that it is a bill that echoes the Trump administration view that farms ought to get big or get out. And again, I think that's a terrible approach to agriculture. We have a lot of small and medium-sized farms, not only here in Massachusetts, but throughout the country. And I think there's value to making sure that we help these farms survive. I mean, I prefer to buy food grown locally. I know that if I get vegetables or if I get, if I buy a tree, you know, that was grown locally, that it wasn't shipped across the country, that didn't utilize excessive amounts of energy, chemicals weren't used, and I mean,
destroying the soil because things that large and that large a scale, having only big things is generally bad for diversity
right.
in general.
Absolutely. You know, again, the farm bill that came out of the House rewards the big farms. Look, I think what's going to happen is we're going to probably have to do a six-month or a year-long extension of the 2018 farm bill, which is not bad compared to what it could be. And then hopefully we come back and it's a new day and we have forward-thinking people and, you know, in control and everything will be beautiful, and we can actually do a farm bill that, you know, lives up to our values. And
are there ways federally to make up for the gaps in the 2018 farm bill in the meantime, if that's what we have to rely upon?
Well, I mean, the 2018 farm bill expires by the end of this year, so you would have to extend it before the end of this year. Was the 2018 farm bill perfect? No. But realistically, until we get a new Congress, I don't think anything new will be added or expanded. So we have to wait and see what happens in the election. We're fighting very hard to make sure that the bill that came out of the House doesn't see the light of day. It won't help the farmers that I represent.
Or the people either.
Or the people either, absolutely. And again, I think in the last few years, there seems to be a new interest in agriculture and in local farms, and you know, people seem to be much more aware of how their food is grown and where it comes from, and I think that's a good thing. I mean, if these farms go to business, what happens to this land? I think this is important. It's important to our economy. It's important to our health and our well-being. And I've had this conversation with the governor, who I know supports a lot of what I support. But you know, I think Massachusetts needs to be more engaged and more supportive of our local farms.
CESA has played a major role in highlighting local agriculture here. CESA is who helps you figure out which farms in this area are you going to go visit. And we're all saying farewell to Phil Korman, the executive director of CESA tonight, who retires this week. Talk about your office's relationship with CESA.
CESA has been an invaluable resource for my office. And Phil has been not only an incredible resource for me personally, but just a treasured friend. He cares about this stuff. It's not just a job for him. It's a passion. And it's hard to believe that he is, you know, moving on because he's been such a fixture at CESA for so long. And ever since I've come out here as a result of redistricting, Phil has been there. I'm sure he will continue to be a resource. But, you know, we have some really incredible people who have made a difference. And Phil is one of them. And so I'm sad to see him move on. On the other hand, he has a life. And we all have, right? I mean, and I'm sure he will do other things that will make a difference for this community and for people who need an advocate.
He's been with CESA for the entirety of that young arborist's life.
Right, and the entirety of the time you've been representing the district.
Yeah, I mean, and he's a nice guy.
I'm going to go grab him before I...
All right.
I'll see you tonight.
Okay,
yeah.
He's
right here.
Just get in the back seat of his car.
Phil Korman, we're crashing your car.
Okay.
We're on the farm tour. This is your last farm tour.
It's my last farm tour my CESA hat on.
You can come whenever you want, I'm sure. Everyone keeps inviting you places. See how loved you are?
It's great to be loved, but that love comes out when you leave.
That's the way it should be. You can't let that go to your head.
No.
We're going to peel you away from this farm tour so we can sit you down with some legendary folks from CESA's past and present to talk about your tenure.
I'd love that.
Now to put some bread on that Phil sandwich.
That is gross.
By which I mean talking with folks from the beginning and end of his time at CESA, Mike Witzman and Kat Chang.
You're listening to the Fabulous 413 on 88.5 NEPM.
Not gross at all.
The Fabulous 413 podcast is funded by the UMass Five College Credit Union, offering co-op advantage checking with cash back on all purchases, plus secure debit card controls, all from the UMass Five mobile banking app. Insured by NCUA, umass5.coop. NEPM's podcasts are funded by Armbrook Village, offering research-based arts, music, fitness, and lifelong learning programs at their assisted living and Alzheimer's care community in Westfield. Armbrookvillage.com.
This is the second time you're doing this, Monte?
Yeah, this is my second rodeo. So I'm a rodeo veteran.
You seem so calm. It's really nice.
Why do they bring you on to do all the exit interviews?
I don't know, but that's what's happening right now. Phil Korman, we're going to have a personal exit interview with you in a little bit. Reminisce about our time together, but you have been the director of CISA, Community Involved in Sustaining Agriculture, for how many years now?
Two to the fourth.
You're making them do math.
I can't do that.
16 years, and I thought if I go two to the fifth, I'm not going to make it.
So where better to say farewell about this segment that we've done than on a farm? And we are here at Warner Farm, the home of Mike's Maize in Sunderland, with the eponymous Mike himself, Mike Wisseman, and with Kat Chang from Reed Farm, where we just visited a few months ago, hanging out with all of your wonderful chickens, and you are the, you know, meta need in this community to have a place where chickens could be raised but also butchered and without having to send them far away and keep the circle closer. And that's what Community Involved in Sustaining Agriculture, CISA, the local hero folks, are all about. And we wanted to bring a young farmer like Kat Chang to talk about CISA and the work, and a really, really old farmer like Mike Wisseman.
I was going to use the word veteran or seasoned
or grizzly.
I could tell instantly where this was going.
But Mike was a board member of CISA, which is a nonprofit, and again, a full disclosure, a sponsor of NEPM, but it's not why we do this. It's an important organization for what goes on here, especially in the Valley. And Mike was a board member in the early days of CISA.
When Phil came on.
Just to be clear, like, I came on year 15 for CISA. Mm-hmm. So there were 15 years before me. There were great people engaged as volunteers and leaders and staff.
So Mike was one of those earlier board members. And Kat, you're a current board member.
I am a current board member. It's my fourth year now.
Five more to go.
Is that the sentence?
FYI.
Yeah. I was going to say, is there a limit to how long you can stay on the board at CISA?
Well, they created that when I was on there.
They want to get you off.
They did.
Well, we had some amazing long-term board members. And when I joined, and Russ Piotr, formerly of WGBY, was the board chair. And Russ and I both felt two things were important. One was we needed to cut down the size a little bit because we were around 20 board members. And I spent half my time just trying to make sure everyone would come to a meeting. And then the other part, it's very healthy for a nonprofit to have some turnover over time, including the executive director role and including board members. So there were not term limits, and we went and set those up as three-year term limits. And I'm always blown away that most people will serve out three-year term limits, because board members give a lot. The organization depends on their experience and diversity of work and farming and communities and geography and all of that. And yet, Kat does have five more years.
But that only means that you're into your second term, which is good. What's different now that you've already served a term?
What's different? Well, it was also weird because when I came on, we were, you know, post-pandemic. So most of the meetings were virtual. The first in-person meeting I think I had was like a year in. So that was very different. And so like now I feel like I've gotten to know people. And we have new people we just brought on. And so I'm getting to know them as well. So it feels like a very comfortable place where people are coming together to talk about something that's important to all of us.
And Kat, you and Reed Farm have come up in a time where CISA was already operating and getting the word out about the importance of shopping local, buying local, and farming and supporting local farmers. But Mike, how long has this, your farm here, Warner Farm, been going?
17, 18.
Really? So hundreds of years.
I look pretty good.
Which means, Reed Farm, you only have 300 years to go to catch up.
I've been on the farm since 1983, which seems like only yesterday, but apparently it might have been the day before yesterday. And we've changed substantially over that time, for sure.
What was the farming climate, pun intended, I guess, like pre-CISA here in the Valley?
You know, when I first got into farming, I always joke that, you know, you were a doctor, a lawyer, garbage collector, and whenever you think, when everybody fell through the screen, the bottom thing was the farmer. Uh-huh. You know, farmers were not anybody, and really CISA turned farmers kind of into rock stars.
You have a whole maze named after you now.
Well, I mean, but really, really the whole, and this was what CISA had before Phil came along, was really the local hero program, and that really catapulted farmers into much more awareness of local farms. And obviously, since Phil's been there, their role has expanded substantially. We can talk about that. But really, it changed how we were perceived. And that was a good thing.
Tell me about some of the things you were trying to accomplish as a board member and a farmer in your tenure as a board member for CISA.
You know, the biggest thing I think was I came from a conventional farm, and really before the 15 previous years was really, CISA was more attuned to organic and smaller farms. And we were a larger farm, and really what I pushed for was we had to broaden our scope. And you know, there were a lot of farms. I was hearing from big farms that really CISA meant nothing to them. And we needed to change that. That certainly has happened. CISA is much more of a go-to.
You know, the other role board members play is to say no when staff come up with creative ideas that won't work.
And one, there's a look.
And one idea we had was we wanted to be part of the Boston indoor market that was starting up. And we, again, it was a creative, interesting idea we had. We wanted to help farms to be able to sell at that market, and CISA would be the vendor. And we thought, oh, that will be good because we can then help them upgrade how they interact with other buyers. We'll see how their business works. And we brought it to a board meeting, and Mike was like, let me just be clear with you. A, you're going to make no money, and B, you're going to make no money and lose money. And then Mike listed out all the reasons, which were very obvious if you were farming and selling wholesale and buying wholesale, but not obvious if you were a nonprofit with a creative idea that won't work.
And I only learned this the hard way because we tried to do a lot of that stuff and realized it's not worth it. It's just not worth it. You can run it. You can stay very busy in farming, and it doesn't necessarily mean you're making any money at all. Maybe the opposite.
Cat can attest to that, I'm sure.
Speaking of opposites, what's one of the programs that CISA's brought up where the board was really, for lack of a better term, on board with that ended up working particularly well?
One was the Emergency Farm Fund, which happened after, I like calling it Hurricane Irene because, like, that's what it felt like. I know some people say Tropical Storm. And that was in 2011. And it was just so clear, like, everyone experienced it who was living in the valley and even the hill towns. So the board was like, sure, go for it. And we, you know, we were lucky enough to have a lawyer on the board who was able to help us set up this fund as a limited liability corporation for CISA. So that was very easy. Another one that was, it was easy also, but it's in part because when you're an executive director and you're bringing an idea to the board, if you bring money with it, then it goes. So, you know, we started thinking about, it feels early on, but it feels like 200 to 400 years late. We started thinking about, we're not representative of the entire three counties. We're not representing all the races and the cultures, and farming is predominantly, excuse me, Mike, white male for that generation around ownership. And so we started thinking and working on this because I was able to bring money to the table where we could start thinking about our programming and how we could enlarge the programming so we include everyone who's interested in farming into CISA services. And that happened about 12, 15 years ago.
We're at Warner Farm in Sunderland. You can hear the sound of tractors in the background. And we're with Mike Wisseman from Warner Farm. And we're with Kat Chang, who's left her farm, Reed Farm, to come over here and say farewell to Phil Korman from CISA, who for the last 16 years has been the executive director of CISA and is retiring as of now.
Right now.
Right now. This is it.
Oh, no,
this is your last
day. Where is that paperwork?
Yeah. You can't go towards that tractor. Its sprayers are up in an X. Yeah.
We are sitting right behind an excavator, though, so if we need to dig a hole to put somebody in it, that's a good tool to use.
You're not supposed to put admissions of guilt on things that will be retained.
Kat, as a newer board member and as a younger farmer who created a farm that fit a need that was not existing here in the valley, what are some of the things that you and your board with CISA are hoping or have achieved?
I think some of the large focuses lately have been climate change adaptations, for sure, and also more environmental justice. More look at the different cultures that are in the area, not only what vegetables are we growing to fit those cultural diets and meals, but also the farmers. And I think for me, those have been the two real focuses that I feel like the board spends a lot of time talking about right now, which I think is really great. And I did want to pull in that the Emergency Farm Fund is how we got our first refrigerated vehicle, which for chicken is extremely important.
Yeah.
You can't ship anything above like 40 degree chicken. Yeah.
We're going to do our own reminiscing with Phil in just a little bit.
In a secluded location.
Yes. But Mike, as we say farewell to Phil, a favorite Phil Korman story.
Oh, gosh. I mean, I'm supposed to do a roast. So
don't use any of the material yet. We want to hear.
I don't have that much material because he's close to perfection. So it's been so hard to find something to put on the grill. But
he's a vegetarian, too. So you can't even roast him like a chicken.
Well, it's zucchini. You can do zucchini. I think Phil, I mean, Phil brings a certain, in the board meetings, we had fun in our board meetings. To Phil's credit, he always brought a sense of humor and certain lightness to the meetings that really allowed us, I think it put everybody at ease. And I think it, you know, ends up being a much more productive meeting when you have some humor thrown in. And I think that's definitely a key to one of, you know, his success is that he's intense in his own way, believe me, but, there's enough humor mixed in and he takes the edge off and we end up having a productive meeting with some fun in it. We did have a lot of fun in the meetings.
What about you, Kat? Reminisce about your time working with Phil.
I think some of my favorite things about Phil is that you always feel really heard and validated, and he's super accessible. Honestly, I still feel so new to farming that I kind of almost feel fraudulent sometimes, but Phil always makes me feel like, yes, I do belong on that board. I have something to say. I have something to share with everybody, and that has always been so wonderful for me.
So the CESA board has served the role that CESA needs, which we talked a little bit about, creative ideas that won't work, and the board says no. But the board should always serve as a really good representative of the community so that you do these trial balloons at a board meeting, and that's how you figure out if it makes sense, because it's not very good when you start a new program and then 500 people think it's a bad idea. So better to have 15 people think it's a bad idea. The other thing is we've really worked hard, this staff and the board, to make sure that we have people from all three counties doing different kinds of work and having different kinds of experiences. And it is so interesting. And even through these very politicized times where people have trouble meeting at picnic tables in front of backhoes,
as we are doing now.
You know,
every meeting should be held with a backhoe.
I think so too.
Yeah. We've had great conversations at CESA, even through COVID, even through, you know, the tough political times that we're going through right now. And so that's been so important. And I think part of it, as Mike always would say, like, oh, there's a little bit of CESA love in that. Feeding people is really ultimately what we all try to do here. And that's where the love comes from.
Mike, now that you're not on the board, how has your interaction with CESA changed?
Well, now I'm looking more at the services they provide, which we haven't really touched on that yet. But since I've been on the board, and then actually way after I left the board, you know, the programs, and you go to the website, and the programs that are available, and the workshops that are available, and all these, you know, learning sessions that are now out there that farmers can participate in and draw knowledge from. So, I mean, it's a huge source of knowledge and wealth for the farmers. And that's what's really changed. That was never around when I first got on. And it's really been in the last 7 or 8 years that's kind of come into being. But
because CESA kind of started with those, you know, the buy local campaign, the local hero, the yellow stickers, yep. You know, like, hey, this is a local product, go buy it. And to train people in the area, these are products that are local, you can support your local economy.
But it worked.
It did work. It worked hugely successful.
That's what drew us out of the bottom of the pot. You know, all of a sudden farmers became, people realized that there was a lot of farming around here, and we became, you know, it got a little wacko, but we weren't really rock stars. But people really, I mean, all of a sudden you go to a meeting and people kind of go, oh, well, yeah, all that's great, instead of having everybody everybody moving away from you. People move towards you. So that was a nice change. But.
And in a way, it's kind of how I got into farming. I worked at a farm-to-table restaurant in Amherst, and the CISA Buy Local Hero program, the restaurant was part of that program. And it was the first time I really thought about, where is our food coming from? And I can choose who I support and where I get my food from. And local food systems are so important. And I did not grow up farming, so it's kind of funny that I'm here now. And so that really pointed me in that direction.
You even got overalls on and everything. You really,
I do.
They're kind of like, they're really cool, like tealish kind of blue color. So a little hipster element there,
well,
too. But still good.
We need more people that didn't grow up in farming, because there's fewer and fewer. And there's certainly going to be, you look around the valley, there's a lot of little codgers like me, and I'm lucky I have my son involved. So the next generation is there, but there's a lot of farms that don't have that.
Yeah.
And there's going to be a big hole. And there's a lot of acres tied up with some of those guys. So it's going to be interesting how things change.
It'll be interesting to see who steps into those roles. And we've kind of alluded to this in many of these farm conversations that we've had. But, you know, there was a time where a generation of Polish immigrants came here and became the farmers
right.
that are now the rock star farmers of the valley that we think of. There are plenty of people who want to do this and are doing it. And will, I think, move into a leadership role that have come not from growing up here in the valley, but have come from all over the world. And I think that's exciting.
And I do think that there's a number of folks who have moved into positions of leadership, whether that's our state reps or state senators, whether at Mass Department of Ag Resources, who are thinking about this with CISA and our partner groups. And I think that's in part, well, some things, you know, that came out of the pandemic, we have to keep going, like the food security infrastructure grants have made possible for a lot of farms that needed to expand to stay into business that were able.
Kat put her hand up. Mike put his hand up.
And so there's just those opportunities just cannot disappear, because the families that are farming, when they let go of the farm and another farmer comes onto it, they don't have that kind of resources. They have to go into debt to buy the farmland and equipment. So if we want food that's grown in this country, in this state, in this valley, the community has to be there in every which way to support that.
Well, Phil, we've told a lot of farmer stories over the years doing this, but now we're going to pull you aside.
Tell your story.
We're going to tell a little of your story and reminisce on our time telling these stories on the air as you say farewell to your role as Executive Director of CISA, Community Involved in Sustaining Agriculture.
This is your CISA life, Phil.
I'm pulling you by your bolo tie into my car.
Don't do that.
Phil wears bolo ties all the time.
Yes, we cannot wrap up our time with Phil Korman without reminiscing with the man himself.
We head into a car to get closing words from Phil himself as he prepares to leave CISA.
You're listening to The Fabulous 413 on 88.5 NEPM.
NEPM's podcasts are funded by Armbrook Village, offering research-based arts, music, fitness, and lifelong learning programs at their assisted living and Alzheimer's care community in Westfield. Armbrookvillage.com.
Let's go to my car, actually. It's too trafficy noise out here. This is. It's fun to do weird interviews in weird places.
Yeah, I agree. The last time we did this in a car, I think we had pizza.
That's right. It was a minivan. We have done, in the year and a half plus of this show, many, many segments with our friend Phil Korman from CISA, the local hero folks, Community Involved in Sustaining Agriculture. One of the first episodes of the Fabulous 413 was going to the Mi Tierra factory and learning how the tortilla gets made.
I asked Antonio what it feels like when the dough's right, so she gave me a small piece to play with, and it's kind of like Play-Doh,
yeah.
Like a little bit softer.
And you can also eat this just like you can eat Play-Doh.
And a little less salty.
I love the saltiness of Play-Doh.
Oh, no.
We've been doing it, Khalees and I, for a year and a half, but Phil, we go way back to my previous show doing this for how many years? Phil's retiring from CISA, so this is like a this is your life of Phil Korman on the radio. How many years have we been doing it on the radio?
We started in 2011. I think I was 23. And so we've done it, me and you together, up until what, 2022? So that was 12 years. And I had figured out that we had done over 500 shows on WRSI.
Whoa. Good thing somebody else is keeping track of that stuff. It's not me. I should also say that my dear friend, the now sadly late newsman, Chris Collins, who was working with WHMP and was a columnist for the Greenfield Recorder, he was having you come on pretty regularly and talking about farm-related issues. And then when he took ill
I guess I took over and I said, this is a great idea and this is important stuff, because I feel like, you know, what makes Western Mass great? Some of it, I say, it's art, it's education, and it's agriculture, amongst other things. But agriculture is such a huge, important part of it. And CESA has been, apart from an underwriter of NEPM, which I should mention, it's part of advocating for agriculture in our area. And it's what has made agriculture stand out in many ways. On the radio, it's been fun to go to farms and have farmers come by and to hear from them all.
With the sad cow stories.
Yeah, lots of sad cow stories.
So many sad cow stories.
Sad flood stories from going back to Irene. CESA having to change under your leadership and morph about how you're going to respond to these ecological disasters that face our farmers, not every single year, but so many years. And it's could be a new variable year to year. What are some of the things that you'll look back on and feel most proud of in your tenure at CESA there, Phil?
You know, I didn't come to this job with much experience in farming. I had farmed before there was woofing in Norway for a month, and it was very clear to the farmer that I grew up on the western part of Long Island, near New York City. So that became obvious. But what I did come to CESA with was the ability to, I think, grow community and encourage people to be part of this community that is so closely connected to the food and the people who grow our food. So that's one thing I feel really good about. And then the other main thing I feel really good about is how CESA has broadened its mission to really focus on everybody who is a resident in the three counties, whether they're a farm worker or a person who right now is on SNAP, and ensuring that our local food supply is not just grown by folks who are farm owners who not happen to be, but are white, and there's lots of reasons for that, and also not just geared to households who have more resources and cars and all of that. So it's not a gourmet ghetto. Our food is grown by neighbors who are growing the food so everybody gets to eat. And the more that we hold that dear to our hearts, the more that we keep this culture and agriculture going.
What are your favorite radio memories of talking about farmers and with farmers and restaurant owners and people that are working with local agriculture in our area over the course of 13 years of doing this?
Wow, do I have some? We once thought about this, Monty, and we spontaneously riffed back and forth. I even think one of our most recent, Jen's Organic, is just great. You come into Mason Square and here is a vegan restaurant owned by a person who is second generation. And they're taking on the Popeyes and the McDonald's of the world here to grow good food that made a difference in her life, sourced locally from farms and served up to her community. I mean, that's amazing. And we do these stories because we want to support this kind of business, small businesses sourcing from small local farms for their communities.
You know what my favorite radio segment is.
I think I do, but why don't you share it, Monty?
I want you to guess.
I think it has to do with Doritos.
Yes, it does. We met an alpaca farmer.
Yes, we did.
Who was retired and went into farming with his wife, and they were raising alpaca. And I had asked him what he did before, and he said he worked for Frito-Lay. And I asked him,
did you invent the Doritos?
He did.
No!
Yes!
I met the guy who invented Doritos.
No, I did not invent the Doritos. Oh.
Yes, he did.
Susan Rice is saying Stephen Rice developed the Doritos.
Well, see, when you are a corporate whore, you can't take full credit for anything.
You were on the team that developed Doritos.
Well, I worked on some flavors for Doritos.
Cool Ranch?
Cool Ranch. I worked on Cool Ranch Doritos.
You're like, this so is like meeting Elvis on the Presley ranch. Right now.
So I can take some partial credit for the Cool Ranch Doritos, but not for the Doritos per se.
Oh, the important one.
Yeah, which is the best one. And that blew my mind.
And you got to hang out with alpacas.
Well, no, we weren't with the alpacas at the time, but yeah.
That's the other part that I think, Kalise and Monty, you both know this maybe even better than me, is in our community, and I'm talking about the three counties, sure we'll throw in the Berkshires for your show,
We want to talk to the Berkshire version of CESA, by the way. We it's on our to-do list.
It is.
I can help make that happen.
Now that you're retiring, they have time.
Now, we work well together with Berkshire Grown. They're amazing. But it's like people have such full and rich lives. It's not just the one thing they're presenting to us in the moment. And it's that unfolding of that story that is so beautiful. So who would have thought that someone who's an alpaca farmer invented the Cool Ranch Dorito flavor? You know, you would never put those. And I know, Monty, you love surprises, and you loved that surprise.
Yeah.
Another show that comes to mind that we did, and we've had them on a couple of times, is Park Hill Orchard.
Yeah.
They were doing IT work in D.C., looking throughout New England for a place to do their next career, which they were committed to farm. And they chose this area because the community and the culture supports local farms. And that's amazing to think someone's coming from outside the area. They choose throughout New England to be here in the valley. The soils help also. And Russell Brain would say, who's the farmer, he's in his 14th year of a 9-year plan. It's just so hard what people do who are farming, and they can't do it without our support. And I will say one other thing. While I've been blown away by how the community steps up during times of challenge, we actually need to step up every day, and when we're buying our food, if we possibly can, if we have the resources, if we have the time, we have to make sure that we're making a wise decision of where we get the food that we're putting on our family's table.
And continue to support the programs that allow the people that don't necessarily have those means to have access as well.
Policy is so important.
Phil Korman, the retiring executive director of CESA, the local hero, folks. Any idea what's next for you?
Yeah, I've been using the word recalibrating, but it doesn't sound as good. I have no idea, but I'm really going to take a breath because I haven't in a bit of time, like decades. I'm going to play a little bit more trumpet, and I will reemerge, because how can one not throw oneself into the fray when the world is so broken?
Vote early and leave the country.
That is another possibility.
Well, we're going to miss you, Phil. I love you. I've loved doing all these radio segments. Over 500, probably pushing 600 now, or maybe even more.
Yeah, at least like 80-ish, 90-ish with us.
And to meet you, Khalees, and talk with you every week has been great.
Aw.
We're going to miss you. Good luck in your next endeavor, and don't be a stranger.
Yeah. I won't. I hope I still get to pull the shopping cart.
Yeah, yeah. We want to see you on the Food Bank March in November. It wouldn't be the same without you.
Thanks so much.
Khalees, do you have a favorite segment in the year and a half that we've been doing these?
I mean, every visit to a farm is its own fun, but I don't think I ever conveyed exactly how close I was to running away with the baby goat that was put in my arms at Thomas Farm. In addition to them making just the best goat cheese around, period, and that is a very biased opinion of A1 Khalees Smith, they let me hold a baby goat, which was the bestest thing ever!
Yeah.
And I have a picture, and it's like, I don't know if I have a picture where I look happier.
And we aired that segment on a rather sad day around here, so it came at a perfect time. We also should say that CESA was very much involved in getting funds out to farmers after the floods,
yes,
working with the governor's office, working with the Community Foundation
and
Western
United
Mass.
Way. Yeah,
it's all good. Well, tomorrow on the show, a deeper look at our communities through their own words, and in song, we'll discover the many faces of food insecurity locally when we hear about the Hampshire County Food Policy Council's Community Story Archive with archivists Johan Rashi Vega, Kristen Whitmore, and Alexandra Mello.
And bring the hills alive with the sound of music in a concert celebrating the compositions and loved work of prolific musician who made the hill towns their home, Alice Parker. I'm Khalees Smith.
I'm Monty Belmonte.
We'll see you tomorrow on the Fabulous 413.